Good morning. Okay. Let's see how this works. I'm glad that everyone managed to adapt to change of venue for this week. Hopefully not too traumatic. Hopefully the elevator will have Rafua Shlema, and by next week we'll be able to be back in our space. It's a beautiful room, but nowhere for anybody to write, unless you're at that privileged table in the back. So we'll work with it. We can survive this too. We survived Caliph Abd al-Mumin. We survived Martin Luther. We can also survive an altered room. I felt very strongly at the end of last week that that I had really thrown a lot of information out there. And so I tried to put a little bit of a summary at the top of the sheet for the start of this week. Also, I'll just remind everybody, phones, please, if you have a phone and you could put it on vibrate silent, that would be very helpful. I can already hear the echoes in the room. That's one of the side effects of, I don't know. What do I know? But hard surfaces, tall ceilings, I don't know, something. But the sound clearly does carry. We talked about what anti-Semitism is, where it comes from, the fact that the term itself is something of a misnomer. But then we moved into the topic of the Almohads and Caliph Abd al-Mumin. So we talked about North Africa and the geography of North Africa. Hopefully all of you saw the email that I sent out following the class with the map, the topographical map of North Africa, so you saw a little more clearly why it was that the Berbers in the western part of North Africa, the area of Morocco, were really set apart from the rest of North Africa. So they have this very tribal culture. They're very austere. A lot of them are in the northern Sahara Desert, so that they've developed as a tough population, and really by necessity not a very materialistic population. And they look at those who are off to the east of them, those who are farming, those who have land, certainly those who have gained power, they look at them as people who have gone soft. And we talked about how in the early days of Islam spreads throughout the region. The Berbers as well as the Arabs take on Islam. And initially, and going into the 10th century, Jews and Christians living under Muslim control are protected with their dhimmi status. And that was what we talked about at the end of last time, a little bit about what dhimmi actually meant. It was an inferior status. Make no mistake about it. You were marked as being separate based on your clothing. You were not allowed to engage in certain trades. It was clearly an inferior status. At the same time, you were protected. You could not be attacked. You could not be forced to convert. And the Almoravids, we said, were a Berber tribe who broke out of the area of Morocco, broke past the Atlas Mountains, and invaded east across North Africa, and invaded north across the Straits of Gibraltar into Iberia, Spain, all the different provinces that are there. And initially, their goal is to spread a somewhat harsher version of Islam, more strict version of Islam, but they become soft over time. We talked about the way historians look at what happens when these tribes that succeed on the basis of tribal culture spread out, and how inevitably they become more urban and lose some of their rough edges. And then the Almohads. And we talked about how the Almohads are inspired by a fellow by the name of Ibn Tumart. He was their religious founder. They are led by Caliph Abd al-Mumin, a lead student of Ibn Tumart, and he leads them even more successfully than the Almoravids in their invasions across North Africa, as well as into Andalusia, into Iberia, that area of Spain, etc. And the Almohads do things differently, and that's really where we had left off. They do things differently on a number of fronts. Their approach to religion is a very strict approach. The belief in one God in particular, the idea that the Almoravids and others don't really have, so to speak, true religion. and their approach to Judaism is different. They are not interested in the idea of dhimmi status. They're not interested in protecting the Christians. They're not interested in protecting the Muslims. Just the opposite. They want conversion. If you take a look on your sheet at source number one, after the bullet point summary, David Korkos, this is from, he wrote the article in Hebrew, I did a translation, but he has a book called Studies in the History of the Jews of Morocco. It's fascinating. I believe I read about him that he was actually a self-taught historian. He was in some other profession, but trained himself. So Ibn Tumart's heir, Abd al-Mumin, executed his political social vision, was faithful to all of his ideas. He follows the ideals of the spiritual founder of the Almohads. During his conquests, acts of intimidation, exile, injustice, etc. were common. The wild soldiers who descended from the Atlas Mountains were more interested in despoiling the towns of the plains than in spreading a religious ideology they did not much understand. His soldiers are barbaric. Hundreds of thousands of Muslims, by the way, yes, that term Berber, yes, they do go together. Hundreds of thousands of Muslims from North Africa and Spain lost their lives in these travels. Many Jews certainly shared their bitter fate. So he emphasizes the brutality of it. But it's more than brutality. It's this desire to convert the Jews. If you take a look at source number two, Amira Benison, Maria Gallego, from Jewish tradition in Fez on the eve of the Almohad conquest. The attitude of Ibn Tumart and his immediate circle towards non-Almohads became clear during their establishment of their community in the high Atlas mountain town at Tin Malal, around 1124. After the Almohads occupied this town, the inhabitants enjoyed a grace period of about 4 years. After which, those who refused to accept Ibn Tumart and his message were brutally driven out and massacred. The most extensive account of the Jewish plight under the Almohads has been recorded in Shlomo HaKohen al-Silji Masi, I believe, missive from Fustat, to his father, coming back from India in 1148. Shlomo HaKohen reports to his father the news from the Maghreb, from the West, that he has learned from a group of Muslim and Jewish travelers who have arrived in Egypt from the Maghreb, where they witnessed the course of events. According to their account, when Sijil Masa surrendered to the Almohads, the new rulers tried to convert the Jews to Islam by debate and persuasion for over 7 months. An episode mentioned as well in a Geniza copy of Avram Ibn Ezra's Lament. We're going to come back to that. From a doctrinal perspective, this correlated with the Almohad mission to convert all Abrahamic monotheists to the true faith. It also matches with Ibn al-Kipt's reference to the grace period offered to non-Muslims by Abd al-Mumin. So he wants to convert those he conquered, the people of the book who had been protected beforehand from this sort of effort, are now vulnerable. And this goes on. I brought you one other source because I felt that it added key elements. In general, I'm trying to cut down on the source material. There's this temptation when you can cut and paste instead of having to write it out yourself and do translations. Like, well, why wouldn't I just cut the entire paper? But I'm trying. Take a look at number three. It is generally assumed that the Almohad conquest was very detrimental for the Jews, and this is not without sound reason. A mass killing of Christians and Jews is said to have taken place during the Almohad conquest of Seville in the year 541/1147. 541 is the Muslim year, from when Muhammad started his travels. 1147 would be Common Era. In spite of the fact that the invaders' violence extended to the Muslim population of the city as well, the fact that both Christian and Muslim historians stress the targeting of dhimmis is significant. According to this source, after having seized Marrakesh, Abd al-Mumin, the first Almohad caliph, expressed his will to put an end to the religions of the book in his domains, to demolish churches and synagogues, to oblige Christians and Jews to convert to Islam. Furthermore, as Molana points out, some Jewish and Muslim sources confirm the veracity of these intentions. In other words, it's not just the Christian sources saying it, all the sources, including the Muslim ones, report it. Among the former, one of the most quoted is a poem composed by Avram ibn Ezra. We already referred to it for a moment in number 2. We're going to talk about it more. In which he lamented the destruction of Jewish communities in Al-Andalus and the Maghreb, including, and you get this long list of communities whose Jewish population was simply wiped out, forced to leave or murdered. As regards Muslim authors, both Eastern and Western historians can be mentioned, and so on. We have many sources that support this version of what happened at this point. There were many more papers I could have quoted. So under Abd al-Mumin, Jews living in North Africa, Jews living in southern, southwestern Europe under the control of the Almohads are given 3 choices. Convert, leave, or die. Those are the options that were left us, and now you start to understand why I put him on this list of history's leading anti-Semites. The reach that he had, the damage he was able to do to the Jewish community was immense. And that leads to a fascinating question. There were all sorts of Jewish sages in these lands in this period of time. And there's a rumor that has been going around for centuries regarding one particular one. A sage whose family started out in Spain, and then because of persecution in Spain, they left Spain. They traveled around the Mediterranean, made it into Israel actually for a brief visit, and ultimately landed in Egypt, settled in Cairo, and I am talking, of course, about Maimonides. Talking about Maimonides. And the question that is raised is, as we're going to see in a little bit, Maimonides talks about what Jews should do when they're living under the Almohads and the Almohads demand a verbal acceptance of Islam. And the question is, what did his family do? Because they managed to make it out of Spain and they made it ultimately to Cairo, right? They're living under control of the Almohads. How did they survive? So I believe in Cairo they were not. I believe that in Cairo they were actually safe from them. But along their journey, they are under them. The Almohads do not succeed in covering all of North Africa. But take a look at source number 4, which is a piece of this conversation. Rabbi Maimon, father of Rambam, father of Rabbi Moses ben Maimon, wrote a letter called the Letter of Consolation in the year 1160, urging Jews living under the Almohads to keep their spirits up, to maintain hope. He writes, "Our brethren, the Jews who are placed into trouble, may God soon have mercy upon you. The troubles which come from God upon his creations are for a good purpose. God will not exchange, will not trade in the Jewish nation. He chose among all of the first nations for another nation." He's not going to trade in the Jewish nation, which he chose among all of the first nations for another nation. "The essence is that one should not cease praying, even if due to the anger of the oppressor and due to the compulsion, one cannot pray the established prayer at its proper time, evening, morning, and noon. One should still pray an abbreviated prayer. At least they should recite daily. They are members of the Jewish nation, holding their Torah in their hearts." He expresses an understanding for the position these Jews are in and says, hang on to your Judaism to whatever extent you can. Now keep in mind, they're originally from, and I'm going to pronounce it wrong because I always pronounce it wrong, either Cordoba or Cordoba. Which one is it? Cordoba. Thank you. But that's where they're from, which falls to the Almohads in the year 1148. At that point, Maimonides himself is 13 years old. That's when they flee through the lands of the Crusades, the lands of the Muslims. They actually go to Morocco. They live in Fez. They're certainly under the Almohads in Fez. That's part of the base. Rabbi Maimon learned from Rabbi Yitzhak Alfasi, who I mentioned briefly last week, one of the greatest authorities of Jewish law, period, ever. And he learns from Rabbi Yehuda HaKohen, who was actually killed by the Muslims. And Maimonides, as we're going to see, is going to write a letter of his own to the Jews who are facing this pressure to convert. So a fellow by the name of Solomon Monk was a key historian of this period in Jewish life in this period. And he felt that the comfort offered by Rabbi Maimon, as well as by Maimonides in his letter, indicated that the family did the faux conversion themselves. That they actually adopted Islam in name, not in practice, not for themselves, but in name, in order to get by. Muslim writers thought so, again, for the same reason. They looked at the text, they saw where they traveled, and said, if they were able to travel this way, it must be that they actually did it. However, it seems very unlikely. And the reason it seems unlikely is because all of this supposition comes about in the 18th, 19th century, reading back to letters that are written back then. We have no contemporary sources supporting the idea whatsoever. We have nothing for the first 500, 600 years after. And keep in mind, Maimonides' life was studied. He was a celebrity. He wasn't no one. Also, the family had other reasons for its special status. Other reasons, of course, generally speaking, means money. They had the ability to get around, literally to get around Europe, and to get around some of the persecutions, even as they did ultimately need to get out of Almohad lands. So it seems unlikely that this actually happened. We have no record of it in Maimonides' own writings. What we will see in a little bit will be what it is within Maimonides' own writing that makes people think that the family actually did this. But it's a very interesting discussion that's been had by historians for the last century or so. The big question that you have to ask is, we talked about motivations for anti-Semitism. Here it's clearly not about Jews per se, because a lot of this applied to Christians under the Almohad control. But why did Al-Mumin do this? Why did he drop the Dhimmi protections and decide, I'm going to abolish all of that and I'm going to either convert or execute the Jews? So if you take a look at source number 5, Delphinus Serrano Ruano offers the following. The reasons why the Almohads saw fit to proceed against the Dhimmis in this manner are not clear. In the case of the Christians, it might be a response to the military and economic pressure exerted by their co-religionists in the north of the Iberian Peninsula, in the Mediterranean, whereas the persecution of Jews remains without a proper explanation. You can put that as the subtitle for the series. The persecution of Jews remains without a proper explanation. The Christians, in other words, were a political threat. And they were. This is still the period of the Crusades. That's still going on. There are wars going on as well, incursions between the Muslim empires and the Christian empires around the Mediterranean, separate from the Crusades, separate from the March on Jerusalem and so on. So that for the Christians, it's very clear that there's a political, military, economic motivation to say, why should we protect them in our lands, convert them or kill them? However, with the Jews, you don't have the same motivation. We weren't that kind of force. Furthermore, as Olivia Remy Constable has pointed out, at the same time that Almohad rulers made life difficult for Jews living in and moving through their territories, they also allowed foreign Christians to trade in Almohad ports. Not to speak of the mercantile treaties undersigned by the Almohad authorities with different Mediterranean Christian powers. There were deals made with the Christians that were not made with the Jews. For his part, Dominique Urvois sees the Almohad's anti-Dhimmi policies as a natural consequence of their ideology, even though the Almohads themselves do not seem to have elaborated any theoretical justification. Dominique Urvois thinks it's religious, it's part of this Almohad drive for a purist version of Islam. We will not accept anybody in our lands who doesn't hold to this. This fact, according to J.P. Molinat, reflects Almohad's awareness that their actions against the tributaries were blameworthy and therefore to be kept hidden or silenced. In other words, the fact they didn't bother to publish a justification suggests they didn't have a justification. So why should we write anything? We don't actually have anything to say. The weight of my readings certainly is that it was ideological. It's part of this revolutionary drive to overturn what they saw as the decadence of their predecessors. Those who came before us allowed the Jews to survive in their lands. They traded with them. They lived alongside them. We're not going to do any of this. This is a religious / philosophical anti-Semitism, and it really is anti-Semitism, even though the Christians face some of this as well. It was lighter when you dealt with the Christians in certain regard, as we just saw in number 5. it was lighter, they were willing to make certain deals, and also there was at least a political, economic reason for doing it. With the Jews, you really didn't have it. Now, I have sort of personalized this with Al-Mumin, painting him as the architect of this, and with good reason. After Ibn Tumar died, he led the movement, and he is the one who was conquering lands and issuing these orders. But it becomes part of the Almohad movement as a whole. If you take a look at number 6 from David Korkos. From the time that 2 research papers of Solomon Monk were published about a century ago, mid-19th century, is it mid? Maybe it's late. I think it's mid. His view has become authoritative regarding the subject we are addressing. In his view, the harassment of Jews by the Almohads was ideological, starting with an official open policy of coercion. And in Monk's picture, it continued throughout a defined time period. Historians who dealt with Jewish history, starting with Zvi, also known as Heinrich Gratz, and ending with Salomon Baron, accepted without reservation the essential elements of his views regarding the position of Jews under Almohad reign. These views seem to have support in the testimony of Latino-Hispanic chronicles, contemporary with the events they describe. The first historians of the North African church, who had other sources, also come to endorse the accepted assumption. The general Hebrew sources seem to provide great support for Monk's view. In other words, that it was about a systematic opposition to Jews that may have started with Al-Mumin, but it continues through the Almohad era. And there are loads of sources that support this, including Jewish sources. We've twice mentioned the poem by Rabbi Avraham Ibn Ezra. Rabbi Avraham Ibn Ezra is one of the foremost biblical commentators. He lives in the beginning of the 12th century. He lives in Muslim Spain. And he, aside from writing his commentary to the Bible, he also writes poetry. He did a lot. He was into math. He was into riddles, actually. Fascinating. But he wrote an elegy for Jewish Spain. In Hebrew, it is titled, Aha Yarad Al Sfarad Ramin Hashamayim, which translates roughly, if non-poetically, to, Woe, evil has descended from heaven upon Spain. Or perhaps misfortune has fallen upon Spain. So I was going to do a translation, and I discovered one online. So I said, okay. In number 7, this is just the first part. It's a long poem. I recommend you have the digital version of this sheet. Click on the link and you can find it. But he describes, this is the beginning of the poem, Oh, woe, misfortune from heaven has fallen upon Sfarad, Sfarad being the term for roughly Spain. My eyes flow with tears, my eyes weep like ostriches on account of Lucena, the ostrich image, Benot Ya'ana in Tanakh, are described in places like the book of Job as creatures which have a very haunting type of a cry. It sounds in the wilderness in places of desolation. That's the image he's invoking here. The exile dwelt there. Sorry? Lucena is one of the cities in Spain that gets destroyed, or the Jewish population gets destroyed. The exile dwelt there blamelessly in safety without interruption for 1,070 years. Right? He's dating it to the destruction of the Second Temple. But the day came when her people were banished and she became like a widow without Torah study or biblical recitation. The Mishnah sealed shut. The Talmud, as though desolate, all its glory vanished with murderers and mourners this way and that. The place of prayer and praise reduced to ill repute. And so on. He goes on for quite a while. He gives us a first-person account of the destruction of these Jewish communities by the Almohads. He's not the only one. There's a work called Sefer HaKabbalah by Rabbi Avraham Ibn Daud. There's a sage, Rabbi Yosef Ibn Aknin, and there's writing about him by the poet Al-Kharizi. Yes, Eti.
Was this written in Hebrew or in Spanish?
Hebrew. He wrote it in Hebrew. Yeah. And we have the original. The link I gave you was just to an English version of it, but it's actually available online. If you were to Google Aha Yarad Al Sfarad or something along those lines, you'll find there's a work called Sefer Hashirim, which publishes the poems of Ibn Ezra, and you could find it in there. So, not everybody agrees that all the Almohads followed suit. Some argue, including David Korkos, that it really ebbed and flowed. Al-Mumin was consistent. The other Almohads, not so much. It went back and forth. But certainly for him, this was a product of his religious fervor. The last piece I want to discuss when we talk about Al-Mu'min is in many ways the most important, which is, so how did we respond? What did we do? When Jews were living under the control of the Almohads, did they say, we're going to accept Islam? Did they flee? Did they die by the sword? What was the policy? So I'm jumping over 8 and 9, not because they're uninteresting, but because we still have Martin Luther to talk about. He's uninteresting. But source number 10, I translated pieces of the letter brought by Moses Maimonides. It's called in Hebrew Igeret Hashmad, the letter of assimilation. Ma'amar al Kiddush Hashem, a declaration on sanctification of the divine name. And he is actually responding to a letter that was published in the Jewish community in Morocco. We don't have the original letter he's answering. We don't even have the name of the person he is answering. I've seen suggestions made about who might have been the author, but these are all supposition. We don't actually know. But boy, is he angry. He is livid. Yes, Susan?
Can this connect with the Inquisition in Spain just afterwards?
No, the Inquisition is really the church's own invention. They didn't require inspiration. There were things the church took from the Muslims. For example, the Jewish badge, the idea that Jews in Christian lands had to wear a particular type of clothing, color, whatever it was, came out of the Dhimmi rules. That was something that they borrowed from the Muslims. So there were elements that they did emulate. But I think the Inquisition was fundamentally a Christian creation. The Muslims did not have, as far as I know, for example, the concept of a court that was actually investigating the claims. It was simply, we move into the area and we tell you, declare that you accept Islam or die. Whereas the Inquisition was run by courts that actually would do an inquest. They would actually examine charges and so forth. They were much more organized about it. So Maimonides is livid, and livid in the way that only a Spanish rabbi can be. By which I mean, the rabbis of Spain were known for their harsh rhetoric. When they disagreed with somebody on a minor legal point or a major philosophical issue, it doesn't matter, they let you know. So, for example, Maimonides talks a lot about principles of faith and what a Jew is supposed to believe. And at one point he says, anyone who believes that God has any physicality whatsoever is a heretic. Rabbi Avram Ibn Daud, different from the Ibn Daud who I mentioned before, writes the classic commentator to Maimonides' works of law. And he says, you know what? People who are greater than you, gedolim v'tovim, people who were bigger than you and people who were better than you had this belief. So maybe you should not talk about this issue or something along those lines. He has no problem voicing himself harshly, and Maimonides takes that view because the letter he's responding to told the Jews of Morocco that faced with this ultimatum by the Almohads, you have to choose to die. If you can get out, get out. But otherwise, you have to martyr yourself. And not only that, because that statement in and of itself is not that novel. We see that statement in other lands by Jews living under the church. That's not in and of itself so novel. What is novel is the statement that if you don't, if you continue to live under the Almohads, and you accept Islam, and in private you perform mitzvot, all your mitzvot are worthless, God isn't interested. He doesn't want your prayers, he doesn't want the Sabbath candles lit in the closet somewhere, he doesn't want any of your mitzvot, he doesn't value what you do. That's what this scholar, anonymous to us, writes. So take a look at source number 10, where I brought you Maimonides' response. And he basically devotes part one of his response to discrediting the initial writer, both personally and for his opinion. We would respond to the body of this man's statement, even though it is long, weak, and burdensome, were it not for our pity upon the great kindness God performed with us, meaning the power of speech, as it is written, who gave man a mouth? It is appropriate for a person to have greater pity upon his power of speech than upon his property, not increasing his speech, minimizing his discussion. So I would go on at length about this, but really you're not supposed to talk too much. It is fitting to know that a person should not speak and orate before the nation's ears until he reviews that which he wishes to say, once, twice, thrice, and four times, studying it well before speaking. This is regarding speech. When a person will engrave it by hand and write it on a book, it will be appropriate for him to review it 1,000 times where possible. And he goes on to say, and this fellow clearly didn't do that because of what the letter that he issued. He goes on, he gets very personal. But moving into part two of Maimonides' letter, the more substantive part of it, he says, absolutely not. Absolutely not. You cannot accept this person's words. He has spoken against the Jewish people. And he writes from part two, if the great pillars of the world, Moses, Elijah, Isaiah, the ministering angels, were so punished when they raised just a few words against the Jewish people. Meaning, we find biblical accounts of sages who said things, or leaders who said things that were critical of the Jewish people, and they were criticized for it. So, for example, when God speaks to Moses at the burning bush, Moses says to God, "V'hein lo ya'aminu li," they're not going to believe me. And God's response to him is to say to him, put your hand inside your coat and take it out. And he does. And when he takes out his hand, it has developed sarat, this kind of whatever it is, ailment, skin ailment that people mistranslate as leprosy. It's not leprosy. Nothing's falling off, for example. But the skin turns white, and sarat is associated with a punishment for, specifically, lashon hara, for saying bad things about others. He's getting rebuked for the fact that he said, the Jews won't believe me. So Maimonides says, if God criticized these people for saying just a few words against the Jewish people, then how much more so the lightest of the world's lightweights, who would loose his tongue upon the communities of Israel, sages, their students, Kohanim and Levites, to call them sinners and wicked people and non-Jews and people who are disqualified from testimony, deniers of the God of Israel. He says, how dare you? One who writes this in his hand, what will be his punishment? And these people did not rebel against God, seeking sweetness and benefit. They did not abandon religion and distance themselves from it in order to achieve benefit and temporal pleasure. They wandered because of weapons, because of outstretched swords, the aligned bow, the weight of war. They were compelled to do this. So how in the world, he says, can you condemn the Jews of Morocco for going along with this? It is also known that Rabbi Meir of the Mishnah's time, early Talmud, was caught to be compelled for shmad, for assimilation, in one of the shmadot in which the sages of Israel were killed. And those who knew him said, are you not Meir? To which he replied, I am not. This is when he was captured. He was captured by Romans. So they wanted to get him to leave Judaism. And they said to him, aren't you Meir? And he said, I'm not. And they said to him, in other words, he's passing as a non-Jew. So they said to him, eat this if you are not a Jew. And there was pig in front of him. And he said, I will eat it willingly. He pretended to eat it, but he didn't eat it. But the point is, he was willing to pass. He was willing to pretend I'm not Jewish rather than taking a stand. So Rambam Maimonides says, how could you write such a letter that's so critical of the Jews of Morocco? Absolutely not. And he goes on. There's a lot more here in part two where he talks about this and how Jews in the days of the Greeks went along with it, and how in the days of Nebuchadnezzar in Babylon, there were many Jews who did bow to Nebuchadnezzar's statue. And then he goes on to the substance of the point and the issue of, if you accept Islam but continue to perform mitzvot in secret, do your mitzvot have value? And that's the part that I bring here from part three. I will now explain the error in which this one who increased emptiness fell. Ahav ben Omri. Ahav was one of the worst kings in Tanakh. He is described biblically as somebody who followed and increased all the sins of his predecessors. He's a little bit of a cryptic figure. There's more to say about him. I'm really only portraying one side of him. But that side is the one that's useful here. Ahab ben Omri, who denied God and worshipped idols, and about whom God testified there was never another like Ahab. He fasted for 2.5 hours when he was rebuked, and And then the sages taught the decree upon him was voided. God did not cheat him of the reward. If God would give good reward for small good deeds for these well-known heretics, then how could God not reward Jews who were forced into Shemad and who performed mitzvot in private? Would there be no distinction for him between those who performed mitzvot and those who did not? Those who served God and those who did not? Can you really think that there is no distinction to be drawn? Absolutely not, says Maimonides. They were forced into it. They do mitzvot. They absolutely are rewarded for it. He brings other examples of it. Again, I'm just abbreviating because that's a long letter. And then finally, in part four of his letter, he gives you the rules for what Jews are supposed to do, what exactly it is that is expected of them. He says, for some of the mitzvot, idolatry, sexual immorality, murder, the law is that whenever one is compelled to violate one of them, meaning the mitzvot, he is instructed to be killed rather than violated at any time, in any place, and in any matter. He says, for these three mitzvot, idolatry, sexual immorality, and murder, it's true that there is a concept of martyrdom. If someone says to you, kill someone else or be killed, you can't kill somebody else to save yourself. So he acknowledges that. But he makes a couple of points. He says, first of all, if one is not killed, but he violates the law because of compulsion, he was forced, so he hasn't done well. What he's done is not good. He desecrates the name of heaven under compulsion. However, he is not liable for one of the seven biblical penalties. We have not found in the entire Torah, not in light or severe laws, any case in which God required punishment of one who was compelled. Punishment is only for those who act willingly. So he says, number one, even if you're going to tell me that they're obligated to not accept Islam, if they don't live up to that expectation, there's no penalty. Well, really, point number one was their mitzvot still have value. Point number two is, there's no penalty. But then he adds something fascinating. He says, you know what they were actually demanding, these almohads? They weren't demanding that you perform, so to speak, Muslim acts. They were demanding that you recite a sentence that says that you accept the validity of the Quran and Muhammad as the last prophet of God. Now, mind you, Jews don't. We don't accept the Quran and we don't accept Muhammad. Fair enough. However, he makes the point, when you generally think about people being forced to assimilate out, you think of a Jew being forced to attend church. You think of a Jew being forced to eat pork. You think of things like that. Desecrate Shabbat. Here, they want you to make a statement, and once you've made the statement, they're going to leave you alone. He says, know that in all of these shmadot, all the forced assimilations of the time of the sages, they were instructed to violate the mitzvot in some action. As the Talmud records, they were told not to involve themselves in Torah, not to circumcise their children, to live with their wives when they were nidot. But in this shmad, what's going on under the almohads, they're not obligated to do anything, only to speak. One who wishes to fulfill all 613 mitzvot in private may do so without liability. So he says, when we are asked whether one should be killed or make this declaration, we tell him, declare it and not be killed. But he should not remain in that king's land. He should sit in his house until he leaves it if he must. He should engage in his activities in secret. We have never seen such a remarkable shmad in which one is not compelled in anything other than speech. So what he advises, it continues on the next page, is get out of Dodge. He says, that's what you should do. And now take a look, the second paragraph on the flip side, starting with the words, the advice. The advice I give for myself and the approach I choose for myself and my loved ones and anyone who seeks my counsel is to leave these places and travel to a place where he can establish his religion and fulfill his Torah without compulsion. That's what he says to do. You have to simply leave. But did you notice the approach I choose for myself and my loved ones? That's what has led people to say he actually faced this and that they accepted this statement that the Almo has wanted them to say and then simply got out as fast as they could. He doesn't say that I actually did it. He doesn't say the advice I gave was to declare the line. He says the advice that I gave was to get out as fast as you can. But that's what gave grist for the suggestion that his family actually did this. There is much, much more to say, obviously, both about the Almohads and about the impact. But I want to content myself to note the following. Maimonides' statement is subject to a lot of debate. There's contemporary debate as to whether he was serious. Meaning, was he making the best of a bad situation? Rabbi Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik, the historian, makes that contention. He says, Maimonides did not actually believe this as law. As a matter of law, he would have said, yes, you have to refuse to accept it, even on penalty of death. However, he knew the Jews couldn't live up to that, and so he gave them the advice they could live with. That's one approach. Not everybody agrees with that statement. But what is certainly true is that Maimonides' words impact Sephardic Jewry in a major way. Because the Jews who lived in Spain were the ones who tended to keep Judaism in secret. Right? The ones who gained that title, not a favorable title, of Marano, Anusim is generally the term we use in Hebrew, those who were compelled, they followed this advice, even when it didn't apply, because the Christians were requiring far more than just uttering a sentence. But they took his approach, as opposed to Jews who lived in Ashkenazi lands, Germany, areas like that, who tended to refuse on penalty of death. They died in greater numbers in Ashkenazi lands than they did in Spanish lands, and the impact really is, it seems, it's a little bit of an oversimplification probably, but not much, the letter of Maimonides. Later authorities, Rabbi Yitzhak ben Sheshet Profet, for example, writing in 15th century Spain, would quote Maimonides' letter as part of their advice for what to do. So the response to the Almohads is get out as fast as we can, but a willingness to make this declaration if need be in order to survive and maintain a Jewish identity in secret. Clear? Okay. We're about 20 minutes left, but we're going to start Martin Luther anyway. I hope that's okay.